Hi, and welcome to the latest episode of Innovation Deciphered. Today, I'm really pleased to have as my guest Hedy Smythe, who I met many years ago at UCL. He ended his career as a professor there, looking into all aspects of project-orientated firms and how they manage themselves. And over the years, I've done lots of collaborations with him, particularly around construction marketing, relationship marketing. But more recently, we've been working, or he did all the work, I did some introductions, looking into mindfulness in project-orientated industries. So today's talk is really, really interesting. It's talking about that piece of work, but also how that has led to some interesting thinking around how project-orientated businesses, think like large construction companies, for example, might think about how they manage their human resources, their people, in a way that would lead eventually to greater efficiency and therefore differentiate themselves in terms of the business model. Anyway, I hope you enjoy today's episode. Hedy, glad you could join us.
Thank you.
Just for the benefit of our viewers, could you just give us a brief potted history about where you spent your career?
Yeah, well, thanks for inviting me. I've spent a time, particularly in my early career, going back and forth from industry to academia. And I personally found that very, very beneficial, getting insights and so on. So I've worked in construction in particular and in property development, and I've worked in academia. The last 20 or so years has been at UCL in what is now the School of Sustainable Construction. And most of my research and a lot of my teaching has focused particularly on how you run firms that run projects, rather than the delivery of projects per se. So that's a slightly different perspective to a lot of people, and includes the work that I've just recently done looking at mindfulness and well-being in project-based industries. Not just construction, but oil and gas, and other sectors, as project sectors as well.
So Hedy, of course, that you've sort of given the clue about how we met, and that was, I'm trying to think, was it 2005 or six now? So nearly 20
about
years
that,
ago.
Yes.
Yeah. So you got to UCL a year or two before me.
Yeah.
I suppose we've collaborated a bit ever since,
yeah,
haven't we, on the various projects. Now, our early collaborations were all about, a lot of it was to do with marketing in the construction industry, and particularly around project-orientated, relationship-based marketing. But more recently, I know that I had a very light touch involvement with this research you just mentioned that you did on mindfulness. Can you tell our viewers a little bit about that? And then hopefully we can then start talking about the conclusions or the recommendations.
Well, there's a project I did with Sarah Hadjikazemi, who's currently at the University of West Scotland, and Mary Durian, who, when we started, which was quite some time ago, there's been quite a bit of interruption to this project. She was at UCL then, but is now at Arab University. And we decided to look at well-being, people who work in project firms and on projects, and to see whether mindfulness had a role in trying to mitigate stress and potentially burnout that challenges the well-being of those that are working and challenges the firms that are trying to deliver projects efficiently and effectively.
And what was the absolute driver for that? I know that from the what I've read around mental health, particularly male mental health, construction particularly is one of the black spots in terms of male suicide.
Yes.
I guess that was part of the background to the motivation for this piece of work.
Yes, because we know it's been rising up the agenda. There's quite a lot of rhetoric. There's some backfilling behind that to put some things in place. But there's a long way to go, because many people, whether they're on projects or working in the main offices, are challenged, particularly in project sectors, by not only intense workloads, but working to deadlines, sometimes working to very tight deadlines, working to temporary contracts and on temporary projects, lots of uncertainties around lots of projects. So all of these, plus cost pressures, all brought to bear at various times, sometimes for extended periods of time. And that means those who are working are under a lot of stress, and that can build up to a level where people aren't so able to handle that. Now, mindfulness has an advantage, whether it's of the Eastern sort or the more common sense sort of reflective practice in a business setting, of trying to help people to be more self-aware of them, of where they are, and put their hand up if they're struggling. But firms can support that as well and get behind it and try and help people to deal with their workload, and also begin to challenge the business model a little bit of firms to try and alleviate the types of stresses and strains that they're working under.
So if just let me test that I've understood what you've just said.
Yeah.
Are you implying that mindfulness and mental health, there's obviously a moral and ethical driver?
Yeah.
But did I pick up that there's also possibly a business driver?
There's a business driver as well, because the short-term hit that firms take from people having under a lot of stress and having burnout is there are hidden costs that don't appear directly on the spreadsheets, but are incurred in the performance of the firm and the projects that they're delivering. And so that holds back the businesses, even more so when there's a shortage of labour around, skilled labour at any one time.
So just for some clarity's sake, obviously if someone is unable to work, that's clearly inefficient. Let's use a fairly harsh word there. But from your work, what do you see as, does it affect judgment-making, judgment calls, decision-making?
It affects their performance as the stress builds up.
Yes, so decision-making, actual efficiency at doing whatever it is.
It affects their morale, not their morality, their morale, because they feel they're not valued. They feel that there are no opportunities for them to grow or grow out of this situation. They become a bit cynical. They begin to distrust some of their management, don't feel that they're behind it. All of that works to actually lower performance, at least constrain it. So when you most need a push, it's not there.
Okay, so that's there's a moral ethical driver.
Yeah, but there's commercial.
There's an actual commercial one as well. So in the work that you did, and you looked at a variety of industries.
Yeah.
Were they all using similar interventions? Was there a spectrum? What did that look like?
They were all using similar interventions and similar initiatives. Some were better than others. Some had hardly any at all. So there was variance depending on the firm. But let's talk about those that were doing something. And the issue was that the initiatives tended not to be joined up. So they'd, for example, hold events, give people free gym membership and so on. In North America in particular, the insurance system made it a little bit more systematic. in that there was external support that the firms would outsource to if someone put their hand up and said, you know, I've had it for the moment. And that was a bit more comprehensive, but whether it's going to a psychologist or having to attend hospital or some other counselling service, there was no integrated strategy. The firms didn't have coherent approaches. So it's a bit fragmented, even where it was a bit more comprehensive. And in some, to some extent, it also allowed the firms themselves to not take responsibility. So managers would go around and say, how's it going? And if it's not going well, then they would take some action. If someone was really under stress, they'd take some action. But they waited until the hidden costs were becoming more apparent to line managers and co-workers. So that even where it was more comprehensive, it was not strategic, it was not holistic, not systematic.
Just take that point you made, strategic. So that you can be strategic in that we've got a toolkit of interventions,
yes,
and we've got a way of watching or measuring what's happening. And as soon as you see, you know, something hits a red, they get sent off to some counselling or meditation, whatever it is that seems to. But of course, there's a much more strategic view than that is. Is there something we can do? Or is it? Do you believe it's possible that something we do that actually reduces the risk of people getting overly stressed? Because there's stress in the moment, isn't there? And it's the prolonged stress, which is...
It's the prolonged stress that's the most damaging.
The once in a blue moon you have to work longer hours.
No.
Because of the deadline. It's not that, is it?
No.
It's gnawing away at you.
Yes.
It may get worse, but you know, it's something that's there.
And it's usually coupled with a combination of factors. Like, I've got a deadline, I've got to work very long hours, and then another deadline comes along and you're working very long hours. You may even be working away from home for prolonged periods of time, and so on. I mean, it's usually a number of things that come together and have a compound effect on how people are feeling. And then it can easily be compounded also by some family difficulties or because there isn't a good work-life balance and so on. So all of these things can come together to undermine people's well-being.
Did you see any evidence of that being looked at really strategically around not having a strategy for dealing with it once it's happened, but to try and minimise the possibility of it?
Well, not only did we see that, the workforce, whether they're working in their firms or geographically separate if the projects are elsewhere, the workforce noticed that. And many of them said to us that it was a commonly repeated thing. We need to monitor our own well-being, but we need more support from the firm. There was a perception that firms were not taking this seriously enough and taking responsibility. We also saw that from all the evidence that was produced, the early warning signs were there. Firms could systematically capture that information from people and from each other as co-workers. They could systematically collect that, process it, and act upon it for those that seem to be suffering the most at any one time and preempt those hidden costs by trying to mitigate it with each individual, helping them personally or bringing in extra resources in the short term if needed to avoid more considerable costs down the line if they just let it run. So that we didn't find in all the project sectors where we undertook interviews, and we undertook 35 in all, 35 interviews, we didn't find any firm that was doing that. So the data's there for them to mine and process, but they weren't doing that. The early warning signs were ignored.
There's an absolute strategic gap that you've uncovered.
Yes.
And they're always exciting because if someone grabs one of those, they've got the potential to, well, to differentiate their business.
Yeah.
Both in terms of, I suppose, making it a more attractive place to work, which when you're in a scarce resource, human resource environment, which we're in, will be forever probably. And, but also, can you conceptualise how this could actually create a commercial edge?
Yes.
What do you think that might look like?
Well, I think it would look like two things, really. Initially, they'd have some information to act upon and improve on things for people. But secondly, I think it would begin to challenge the business model over a period of time. And they would feel uncomfortable with that because it would mean more resource commitment over the longer run. And that's fine in that it causes a short-term problem. But if project-based industries really, particularly those where they're outsourced, well, if they really want to improve performance, they need to make investments longer run because the current models are not totally functional. In some sectors, it's worse than others. Construction, for example, is particularly poor. It's a dysfunctional business model that's predominantly being used. If you want continuous improvement in project performance, you need to invest in order to make those improvements in a whole range of potential areas. Firms can differentiate themselves by choosing an area. Well-being is one of them.
And of course, the large tier one contractors, as an example, and also the large consultancies, the engineering consultancies, they all say the same thing. Our asset is our people.
Yeah.
And it is a...
But there's a potential.
There's a gap, there's an absolute blind spot here, isn't there?
There is.
Around...
Completely.
Yeah, the performance of your asset, if you're going to sort of dehumanise it a bit, is affected by this.
Yes.
And therefore... In the same way that you'd have a strategy for managing the well-being of your plant,
yes,
so that it remains functional and efficient and doesn't blow out too much CO2 and soot, all of that's monitored now, isn't it?
Yes.
All of that is looked after because if it stops working, it can't be productive.
Yes.
Whereas most of the money is spent on people.
Yeah.
I mean, in the work we do, we look an awful lot at payroll costs and things like that. They're hundreds of millions in these large businesses every year.
Yeah.
And if you think you're spending 150 million on people directly and they're operating at 5 or 10% below where they were, there's a huge gap. There's a huge amount of money.
Massive gap, yes.
That needs to be... you could improve efficiency and well-being at the same time.
Yeah. But to handle the short-term problem, senior management and the finance departments would need to develop plans in order to incrementally shift. So it's not challenging them too much in the short run, but over the longer run, one or two things are introduced every year according to a strategic approach to build up the capability. So that over, say, a 5-year period, well-being, as an example, is being really dealt with much beyond the current rhetoric of it being said to be important and just pointing to two or three fragmented initiatives that are not joined up. But they could really build it up over a period of time and make a difference. And the successive investment would bring back results.
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting concept that if you're spending this huge amount of money on your payroll, if that was a diesel engine and it was only giving you 30 miles per gallon and it should be 50, it'd be straight in the garage, wouldn't it, to get fixed?
It would. And I mean, the key difference, the analogy with plant and engines and so on is a good one, but it runs out at one point, and that is that when you invest in an asset, it depreciates with use. The minute you take it out of the shed, it having been maintained, it begins to wear. And I think what's not commonly appreciated is if you invest in people, it actually appreciates with use. Because people working together, they learn off each other, they get used to each other. So far from having depreciation, you have appreciation of that social asset, if you like, in your organisation that builds over time. So, for example, you can link different things and then get even more out of it. So if you start developing systematically well-being, you've got all the early warning signs, you're processing that, you're acting upon it. If you then link it to knowledge management, and don't just see knowledge management as a technical issue, you can then begin to roll out the learning from that on a wider basis. So that's the sort of way in which it becomes more and more of an appreciating asset.
Yeah, I mean, yes, you're right. It's a bit like fields of corn, isn't it?
Yeah.
Your people are the seeds, and when they germinate, and if you look after them, they're eventually going to grow, and then they're going to produce a crop.
Absolutely.
And of course, you want them to reach maturity,
and then
the cycle will start again as they retire and new people come on.
Exactly. All that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's a really interesting way of thinking about human resources as an appreciating asset. But on the same as a human, I don't know, as you get older, you start to worry more about your health, and you start, these days you're collecting loads of data on yourself, or at least I am, and you worry about it a little bit, but you know that in the end, it's actually, there's a good outcome, or at least there's an intended good outcome.
Yeah.
That you maintain your health at an acceptable level as long as possible, which is most people try and do.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, I try and do it.
Yeah, most people do, don't they? Apart from the real hedonist, but I was never quite there. Okay, Hedy, that's been a really interesting discussion around how a piece of research into well-being, which is a now topic.
Mm.
How that can actually potentially, or should it perhaps, for certain firms, influence their strategy, particularly where they're reliant mostly on human resources to make their business case
absolutely
work.
Yes.
Which is, I think that's a fascinating conclusion.
Yeah.
And, well, I think that's a great place to stop. So, Hedy, thank you very much for coming. It's been a pleasure as always.
Yes.
And to everyone out there, see you on the next episode.